You are here at 4ZZZ on Brisbane Line, and Susan Ford, an associate professor, the director of Griffith University Center of Social and Cultural Research, is with us to discuss the Mavo Indigenous land rights. That's a mouthful. 3rd of June marks its 25th anniversary. That's this Saturday. And we'll talk about, like, its current status and, you know, future and all that kind of stuff. And for you people who don't know what it is, you'll learn what it is. Hey, Susan, how's it going?
Hi, I'm great. Thanks.
And Nicole is still here with us, just so, you know, you all know that.
Yep, I'm still definitely here.
So that big, huge university center, Griffith University Center of Social and Culture Research, what is that?
So it's a broad humanities and social science research center at Griffith University. Within that, a lot of research centers are quite specific in what they look at, but our center is really broad. So we've got all of our humanities scholars in there, so historians, literary studies, journalism and media, newer fields like security studies, migration.
What is sociology?
Security studies is an emerging field. It's really come out of international relations, actually, so politics and international relations. But we have some really great humanities scholars.
Is this about like leaks?
Security studies.
Like the leaks and stuff?
No. So if you were doing security studies within a criminology context, say, for example, or even an IR context, it would be about national security, policing security, and those sorts of things. But our people look at it in terms of human security, so food security, water security, migration. What is the personal security of people who are fleeing their own lands and the security of their children? What happens in refugee camps in terms of personal security?
And you're at the South Brisbane campus?
I'm at the Nathan campus,
but
we have people at the Nathan campus and at the Gold Coast campus and some at our South Bank campus as well. But we're primarily a Nathan-based centre, which is where most of the humanities researchers at Griffith University are.
Now, just launching into this, Mabo Indigenous land rights. How did it first evolve? Earlier, Nicole told us a little bit, like, you know, just like out of a Wikipedia-ish kind of a way, like who Eddie Mabo is. So what is it and how did it first evolve and what's its impact at the time?
Yeah, I mean, Mabo was you know, it's called a landmark decision, which it was. It was a native title decision, more so than just an Indigenous rights decision. It was a native title decision which finally said Australia was not terra nullius. When the white ships arrived, it wasn't an empty land. There were, in fact, people here, and they had their own society and families and ways and cultures, and that was finally recognised. I mean, Australia, unlike every other colonised country, still does not have a treaty with its Indigenous people and did not recognise that Aboriginal people were here. That's why the 67 referendum was so important.
Another anniversary coming up.
That's right. In fact, it was a few years before 67 that Aboriginal people were actually taken out of the Fauna and Flora Act. And this was how, you know, the colonial government had got around saying there was nobody here. They put Aboriginal people into the Fauna and Flora Act, which is about animals and plants. So they could say there weren't actually a people here. There were these, you know, groups running around that killing kangaroos and stuff.
That weren't real people,
well,
effectively.
Well, that's right, because they were under the Fauna and Flora Act. And so that was how they were able to claim terra nullius. They just called it the empty land. There's no one here. It's ripe for the claiming. And that meant that they didn't have to make treaties as they did in New Zealand with the Waitangi Treaty, as they did in Canada with the First Nations people there. So Mabo was so significant for Australian law and Australian society for that reason, that it was a decision to say, stop this lie. There was a whole, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of people here when the ships arrived, and their society has been, you know, denigrated and demolished.
So how did Eddie Mabo get the wherewithal to make this happen?
It would appear that Eddie Mabo was just an incredibly courageous and committed person who believed so strongly in his own right over his land on Murr Island in the Torres Strait that he just continued to pursue it through the courts. He had great backup from a number of lawyers and barristers who did all pro bono work, because they just wanted to test the Australian law and test the Australian Constitution. They also wholeheartedly believed that we could not sustain this terra nullius. And as soon as we admitted that the land was not terra nullius, that led to a whole series of actions legislatively.
And ultimately our apology and also like our preambles whenever we have public events and on the ends of our emails. And
that's right. So it's just, you know, helped Australia, I think, to some extent recognise the very unique place that Aboriginal people, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people hold in our society. And in fact, the very unique place that we are, that we have the oldest living culture here, and we can finally, and we should have been, of course, from the beginning, recognising it as something very unique and special about this land.
Was anyone trying to take something away from him that caused him to start this, or he was just doing this from a humanist way for his group?
I think Mabo could see that, in fact, he had no, he was unable, I can't remember the exact details, but I'm sure Mabo was trying to do something on the land and he was unable to because he wasn't recognised as the proper owner of the land. I think there were also issues about passing land on, you know, in a real sense. And so, you know, Mabo knew that this land had been in his family for generations and generations. It was part of their oral culture. Everybody knew, you know, down to the last patch of grass, who owned what, which family owned what. And he was able to demonstrate that very clearly to the people. I do recall the court decisions at the time. You know, the judges all went out, of the judges of the High Court all did a visit, a number of site visits to Murra Island with Eddie Mabo and all the barristers and lawyers traipsing around the Torres Strait, where he was so clear about who was who and what was what, and what their living culture was. And it was very convincing to the High Court that, in fact, we couldn't sustain this anymore.
Now, we just take this for granted, or anybody who's come up after this, or, you know, in terms of people like millennials would just take this for granted, for example. Was the decision controversial at the time?
Yes, it was. I mean, I think there was, I know there was a lot of support for the decision at the time. It was a Keating Labor government. Keating had made the Redfern speech only a few years earlier, so this is a really important time in Australian
history.
And
what is the Redfern speech?
So the Redfern speech was a speech that Keating made in the Sydney suburb of Redfern area, very closely associated with Aboriginal people. And in that speech, Keating said, "We stole the land. You know, we committed the murders. We took the children. We raped the women." And it was such a powerful speech. And there's been a lot written about the Redfern speech since because of the wording of it and the rhetoric of it. Keating delivered it in such a blasé way, in a sense. You know, he was standing in this Redfern park. There was no major media there, unlike the apology. There was no major media there. There were a few people filming it. Somebody else recorded it on a little audio recorder. But it's actually become one of the most important speeches in Australian political history because it was the first time the leader of our nation started saying, "This is what we did. It's time to fix it." And it was a December speech just before the launch of the World's Indigenous Peoples, which was the following year. And then after that, then Native Title came through. So there was a whole narrative started around that time under Hawke and pursued more strongly under Keating that this was a time for Australia to change its attitudes. So I think there was a lot of support in answer to your question because of that building momentum around it. But undoubtedly, you know, and as I've written and said in other forum, there's an inherent racism in Australian society which comes from that terra nullius notion, really, you know, the great Australian silence. And so there is an inherent racism in, you know, a great many parts of Australia. And so in those parts, there was significant opposition.
That just brings me back to something else I wanted to talk about. There were significant parts to Australian society that really pushed back. And if anybody studies the way that the Australian media reported on this, it's quite shocking, isn't it, how it seemed to be almost overwhelmingly negative. Well, that's the opinion that I saw looking back on this when I was at university, because we had to look at how the media portrayed Mabo.
Yeah, absolutely. And we know that the very powerful lobby groups in Australian society are mining, pastoralists, you know, landholders. And so those two lobby groups, of course, felt seriously threatened. And so they started making claims, very well-funded campaigns, that, in fact, farmers were going to lose their land and lose their livelihood, and they deserved to stay there because they'd been there for, you know, three or four generations. Strong push from pastoralists and groups like the National Farmers Federation. and very strong pushes from mining. We are no longer going to be able to explore. We're going to have to get the permission of these local people who know nothing about anything to even just be able to explore, let alone to mine. So a huge fear campaign basically saying this is going to stop the Australian economy. This is going to stop our two major industries of agriculture and mining. Nobody will invest here because we can't provide them with any certainty that they can go ahead with investment. And then you had the newspapers, and I remember so clearly they kept using this term blacks. And I knew as a journalist at the time who'd learnt subbing that blacks is a good, short word which says what it needs to say. It's easier than Indigenous, it's easier than Aboriginal, it's easier than Torres Strait Islanders, blacks. So all these headlines, blacks claim CBD, blacks claim ECHA, blacks claim, you know.
I heard Perth Airport.
Yeah, you know, just ridiculous things coming out about what areas of the country people going to claim. They were absolutely was pushed that they were going to be able to claim individual people's backyards.
I remember that at the time.
And that people were going to lose their houses. I mean, it was crazy. I think there was a good proportion of people who didn't believe that sensational, ridiculous argument, but it was certainly very dominant and a lot of people did believe it.
And I've also heard anecdotes. I had been up to the Kimberleys. This was back around 1996. So it was only a couple of years after this had come through. This woman had told me that after like trying not to say anything and biting her lip, that there was a lot of Southern white lawyers coming up, stirring things up and causing land right claims that weren't necessarily, some of them might be valid, but there were also ones that weren't valid, you know, because they thought like there was going to be money that they could both split. So, I mean, because there's abuses to everything. Have you heard anything like abuse-wise?
Oh, that's, you know, always been there and, you know, in the way that people talk about native title, you know, that bogus groups are starting up to be able to get their hands on them, on the money, or to be able to get their hands on land. I mean, I think that's a, you know, vast minority, you know, a very small minority.
But it can happen too. It's like nothing's perfect.
Well, nothing's perfect, but, you know, it's also the impact of colonisation, isn't it? That, you know, we took people from their land. We removed them 600 kilometres from the land and place and mountains and water holes that they knew and stuck them on Warrabinder and Doomadgee and Cherbourg and
those are all Aboriginal Perga. Communities up north, for people that don't know.
All over Queensland, yeah.
Yes, it was obviously a hysteria campaign from what you were telling me, but was any of it justified, though? On any level?
No, I don't think it was, in the sense that native title, you know, we now know 20 years down the track, native title has delivered very little to Aboriginal people. No one's land was under threat. You know, mining companies finally had to not have carte blanche over everything that they did and over every square of land. They had to negotiate with local people. You know, people were, you know, living on $200 a week, $300 a week, and mining companies were making billions and billions of dollars out of land that had never been rightfully taken. They never paid for it. Nobody's ever paid for it. And Aboriginal people were living in extreme poverty. They couldn't even get jobs before native title and before Mabo. It's only since this era of reconciliation and native title that mining companies have been forced to, you know, employ certain numbers of Aboriginal people. Before that, there were, you know, I mean, there was odd people working in the mines here and there and on pastoral companies in the old days when they didn't have to pay them properly. But as soon as Aboriginal people had to start getting full wages, a lot of them lost their jobs in the pastoral industry. And the mining companies were, you know, not investing in employing Aboriginal people and training them up at all. It's only since this time that they've been forced to do that. So I don't think any of the hysteria around native title was justified. I think that all of the reporting should have been, well, it's about time. Good decision. Finally, Aboriginal people, as the oldest living culture in the world, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, the oldest living culture in the world, after 200 years of disgraceful treatment and oppression, getting something back that they're due, getting somehow, in some minor way, compensated for the complete disruption and demolition of their lives and their culture and their languages.
And where are we with it today, and where do you see it going? Like, is it being built on, or have we just accepted it and it's just a done deal and there's nothing to add to it?
Yeah. When John Howard got in 1996, he made a point of starting to dismantle the Native Title Act quite significantly, and there was the Howard 10-point plan, which actually undid a lot of the stronger parts of the Native Title Act, which would have given Aboriginal people much more significant input and say over mining, high levels of compensation.
Is it still like that?
Yeah, and so Howard's 10-point plan has stayed in place, and the powers that were given and the rights that were given to Aboriginal people under the original Native Title Act were watered down, you know, about 5 years after the Native Title Act actually passed.
Was that what the Wick decision was?
No, the Wick decision was actually a very important decision because it recognised that native title could exist alongside pastoral leases. So previously it had been written, and I couldn't tell you exactly, Nicole, whether that was in the original Native Title Act or under the 10-point plan, that pastoral leases extinguished native title. So the Wick people fought and proved that in fact native title was not extinguished by pastoral lease, that if the Aboriginal people had maintained their connection to that land, then native title could still be claimed and still existed. That's probably a big weakness of the Native Title Act as well, that Aboriginal people have to prove continual occupation and knowledge of the land and their culture. Well, you know, when you're removing more than half, two-thirds of a population away from their lands so that you are able to mine it, so that you are able to farm it, so that they're not harassing people, then, you know, that's a difficult case for some Aboriginal people to make, and that's not right.
And are you aware of anything that's going on now, like any lobbying groups to try to put back, like, what Howard turned back, you know, like, and especially now with the anniversary coming up?
Yeah. I think Aboriginal people, certainly more radical Aboriginal activists, feel that native title hasn't delivered much to them at all. That it was a ruse and it was a distraction, and it hasn't delivered anything in terms of land rights. You know, they were fighting for land rights. We were fighting for land rights through the 80s and the 90s, and native title was supposed to be the answer to land rights, but it hasn't really delivered that. So there is now a very strong movement for sovereignty, you know, to just say, not only do we own this land, we are the sovereign peoples of this land, and that we need to have a significant voice, you know, in Australian society and in amongst public debate. I think the Uluru Statement from the Heart, you know, encompasses that to a large extent, you know, requiring a permanent voice for Aboriginal people in Parliament and re-looking at the way land is understood and looking at the way Australia understands its national identity in relation to Aboriginal people and Indigenous history. I think that's the big move that's on at the moment, and I think it's important because a lot of people, in fact, have not been able to access anything as a result of native title because their families were removed from their lands.
Is there a place like some of our listeners can go to be able to get involved with helping lobby anything in this direction or getting more informed?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of really good groups around. I'd probably recommend a really good blog called Indigenous X, which is run by an Aboriginal man in Melbourne, I believe, Luke Pearson. There's another one called SOS Black Australia. There's a number of bloggers out there. There's a Sovereign Peoples site as well that you can go to for information about how, you know, rallies that are on. There's one called that I subscribe to on Facebook. It's just called Aboriginal News or something like that. But it does let you know about different groups. It reposts material from groups. I would say if you hook up with that Indigenous X Twitter site, or go to any links through from there, you'll be pretty well informed about the sovereignty movement and about movements related to sovereignty that might just be about Aboriginal people getting a voice in Parliament or dealing with incarceration rates of Aboriginal people.
That leads me to the next thing too, getting back to, I suppose, the, I might be being presumptuous using this word, but the evolution of Mabo and the issue and how it's being reported in the media. Do you hold out any hopes for the improvement, the way that the mainstream media talks about these issues?
I mean, unlike the early 90s, you know, native title and Mabo and the Mabo decision is not, you know, on everyone's radar in the way that it was. I remember when I was first a journalist covering Aboriginal affairs, there was, I reckon, 30%, 20 to 30% of the news for about 2 or 3 years there was Indigenous news. So all of the newspapers were putting on specialist Indigenous affairs reporters. New newspapers were popping up, which one that I was involved in called Land Rights Queensland, where we had staff covering this news all the time because it was just so prominent. So I would say that Native Title and Mabo and the impact on Australia and that sort of is not, you know, at the top of the news agenda as it used to be. I think attitudes have shifted a lot. I think the attitudes of a lot of journalists have shifted. You know, they've become used to the notion that, in fact, this is no great threat to the Australian economy and the Australian way of life and all that sort of thing. And there's just so much information now around closing the gap and the fact that, you know, Aboriginal people are really quite disadvantaged socioeconomically as well as in terms of, you know, yeah, incarceration rates. Health-wise, you know, infant mortality, early death, diabetes, all of those things are really serious issues in some Aboriginal communities. And I think there's just a lot more awareness around about that now, both in the general population and amongst journalists and editors. And that's really important in terms of what news agenda is set. If there was a big change to Native Title so that, hypothetically, they completely reversed Howard's 10-point plan and went back to the original, what sort of coverage would we see? I think we'd be pretty much back to where we were, which is significant concern about the economics of all of this and how this is going to impact on Australia and development. But I think there is more understanding about it now and more understanding about the important place that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people hold and the special place that they hold and should hold in Australian society and in our history and our future.
Thanks, Susan, for coming in. Really appreciate you sharing all this. I had no idea that it had been turned back somewhat. So that's a surprise to me because I thought it was more like of a joyous kind of a occasion of like moving forward. But apparently what you're saying is it's a bit hollow. Is there anything else that you want to say, like just like in parting? Because we're at pretty much at the end of our show here.
No, I just want to say thank you for inviting me to be on Brisbane Line. It's an institution in, you know, Brisbane radical life and activist politics. So I'm honoured to be here. Thank you for asking me.